Okay. Before I actually go into the next part, I want to try another little thing with you. Of the people who are white here, how many of you have discussed whiteness in your therapy?
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
But not everybody. And people who are black here, how many of you discussed your blackness in your therapy? All of you. Yeah. So it's not an issue that's often discussed in therapy, and amazing that some of you have. That's great. So I'm going to talk now about a model for developing a white awareness. We can see from what I've said before the break that development of white awareness is a process that involves the whole person. It is not something that can be just understood and accepted intellectually. White awareness involves our emotional responses to unconscious prompts that have developed not only over our lifetime, but in the cultural consciousness of the society in which we live. I've developed a cyclical model showing the process which can lead to white people becoming more aware of their white privilege. This cycle may go through several turns during our life as over and again, and at different levels, we deny the issues that of the effect of our whiteness in society. If we are at all sensitive to issues of race, the issue of the responsibility of white people for race tensions, both in the present and historically, are likely to become evident. Feelings of guilt may follow, which can lead to a more internal exploration. How am I responsible? A struggle to make sense of these feelings and to own our part in white privilege can lead finally to a sense of integration in which we fully accept our part in this privileged position and naturally act in the world in a way that, as far as possible, does not perpetuate the situation. Diagrammatically, this cyclical model, looks like this. I just wanted to turn towards it. I don't know if that's on, actually. Is it on? Yes. So you can see you start with denial and then struggle to understand the others. There's, you know, when you start to stop being so much into denial, there's a starting to understand the other. And then through that, a feeling of guilt and shame. And then through that, maybe would lead one to try to understand ourselves. And that could lead to integration and to a more intersubjective way of understanding the whole situation. So I've devised the model as a cycle because this is not a once and forever process but one that recurs and the learning deepens through every turn of the cycle. The model builds on two other models. Maybe some of you know them. One is the Helms White Identity Model and the other is Van Riedenberger's Intercultural Sensitivity Model. Like mine, Helms shows a period of ignorance or acceptance of the status quo, a period of struggle and disintegration, followed by a more thorough understanding that she calls autonomy. Van Riedenberg's model is not specifically about white awareness, but shows a similar process for understanding intercultural working that goes through denial, defensiveness, acceptance, cognitive adaptability, and behavioural adaptability. Neither of these models includes feelings of guilt or shame as part of this process. My own view is that these feelings, as I've shown earlier, are often important to a deepening of understanding and a genuine sense of acceptance. It is quite possible and probably quite common to be stuck at the different stages which lead towards integration. So what happens if one is stuck at any of these stages? So being stuck at the stage of denial. Maybe most of the population is in a state of denial about the responsibility white people have for racism. It is quite common to hear a white person say, "I am not racist, but..." And there is now More pressure on the borders, as there is now more pressure on the borders of Western countries from people who wish to immigrate, either for economic or political reasons, racist views have become more prevalent, with an accompanying tendency to deny them. For instance, there is a debate in Britain as to whether it should encourage, or even force, minority ethnic groups to integrate into British mainstream culture, or whether ethnic communities should be encouraged to keep their identity as British people. This issue has become very hot, and words are chosen carefully so as not to inflame the situation. The word culture is more often used than race, but issues of race seem to be present, as non-white groups seem to be most feared in this regard. This whole debate looks different if white Western people see themselves as also having a race, but one which is privileged. A more complex view of the interrelating of cultures becomes possible when white people are not seen as the normal ones. The issue is further inflamed by white British people who live in poverty, feeling that they have been forgotten in the priorities that are set by local and national government. All these pressures can lead to racist views emerging whilst also being denied. So, being stuck at the stage of a struggle to understand others. Number two. Many people, maybe therapists in particular, who desire to work well within this complex intercultural environment, are stuck at this stage. There is a tendency here to keep the understanding at a cognitive level so that ways of behaving in a politically correct manner can be taken on board. In the book, I explore more about the meaning and use of political correctness. A rational understanding of the issues can be present, but the full implication of being white is not deeply understood, and feelings of guilt and shame are resisted. So being stuck at the stage of guilt and shame. As I've already shown, a sense of guilt or shame can warn us that something is amiss and can deepen our understanding. It alerts us to how we are complicit in white privilege. However, being stuck in a guilty or a shame position can lead to feelings of impotence and helplessness, and in no way improves the lives of those that one feels guilty or ashamed about. In fact, it can lead to black people feeling that they should absolve the people who feel guilty and ashamed in order to put them out of their misery. Being stuck at the stage of struggle to understand self. Insofar as the meaning and effects of whiteness are far-reaching and run deep in the psyche, maybe it is not such a bad thing to be stuck at this stage. However, if we are to engage in our racialized society in a way which fully owns our complicity in white privilege, then coming to an understanding from which it is possible to relate and act with integrity is a powerful and political act. Just staying in a place of struggle may absolve us of the need to do this, and our actions will be less graceful because they are not fully integrated. So being stuck at the stage of integration. This may seem like the Shangri-La of white awareness, but it can lead to complacency and its own sort of denial, a denial that further understanding is possible. Another turn of the cycle may lead to an even deeper understanding. Those who have fully integrated an awareness of their whiteness with all that means in terms of their privilege are able to step back from an over-identification with whiteness and understand the situation within its systemic and intersubjective context. As I mentioned before the break, if we understand the world in a systemic or intersubjective way, we see the interconnectedness of everything and understand that we take part in a complex web of relationships. This deep understanding of the whole picture, including our own complicity in racism, can lead to a more authentic and less defensive way of relating within a racialized environment. This is not easy, and typically defensive denial in the face of ridicule or hostility from others can return. In this case, a further turn of the cycle might occur. There may be an understanding that racism occurs within an intersubjective context, but it is hard not to be personally reactive when put under pressure. A further turn of the cycle may look like this. So, starting off with denial of the systemic context under pressure, and then a struggle to understand the other within their context, and guilt and shame about their different context, to a struggle to understand the self within intersubjective context, and then fully understanding one's participation within a web of relationships. So that's my attempt to look at what a further turn of the cycle might look like. In each position, an understanding of the context in which racial relationships occur will deepen the understanding possible. But now racism is understood to be woven into the fabric of society rather than just personal. By taking an attitude in which one is interested in the returning racism, we find ourselves in ourselves, that we find in ourselves, we may otherwise feel dispiriting, which may otherwise feel dispiriting, enables an ability to deepen an understanding rather than a return to entrenched denial. The more one revisits this place, the more trust in this exploratory process is strengthened. We can be both really in touch with a painful way in which our racism and the part that plays within the embedded racism of society, and at the same time have a sense of non-reactivity and non-attached interest in the process we go through. So, in conclusion, I want to just make some concluding comments about the whole now. It is not easy to fully understand our own position as white people if what we think we are seems to be just normal, particularly if that normality affords us an easy, privileged position in society. I find when I try to explain to white people what my book is about that they have trouble getting it. Black people have no difficulty at all, I've found. We white people are like fish that swim in a white sea. A fish does not know that the sea exists. We find it hard to stand back and see what's going on in the way that black people can. I have tried to bring this invisible white context into focus and hope that by becoming more white aware that we will work more sensitively and effectively within a racialized context. Maybe this will help to contribute to a more peaceful world. In conclusion, I have discovered that when considering matters of race, it is good if we, one, start with ourselves, because white is a privileged racial category. Two, remember that racism is built into the organizing principles of society, and I'm going to say more about that in a minute. Develop a dialogic and inquiring attitude. Don't dismiss feelings of guilt and shame. Remember that change in us as psychotherapists and counselors comes as part and parcel with change at both individual and societal levels. Having identified these factors, I will finish by making some concluding statements about each of them. Starting with ourselves, because white is a privileged racial category. If we are to really tackle racism, we need to stop looking through binoculars and look in the mirror instead. I find that once understood, this statement becomes more and more evident. As I have shown, I do not think that understanding one's place as a white person within a racialized environment means that our values have to be abandoned or even put to one side. Dialogue across these differences can lead to changes or just to tolerating and allowing for difference. In either case, there is a genuine respect for difference, and the white way is not seen as the only or best one. So the next one is, remember that racism is built into the organizing principles of society. As I have shown, it now seems to me that racism exists within the organizing principles of every individual and within what I call the organizing principles of one's culture. I've drawn on the work of the intersubjective psychotherapist Stoller and Atwood et al., who describe the organizing principles of the mind, so-called because they refer to its structure rather than its content and are thus unavailable to be directly reflected upon. These principles are not conscious because, like the blueprint or architectural drawings of a house, they are not evident in daily life. We are conscious of the floor and the walls, but not of the original ideas about them when they were conceived. The drawings can be referred to, but not actually experienced in the way we experience living in the house. The values and assumptions that underlie our way of being in the world are arranged according to our organizing principles, and we live our life by them most of the time without questioning or even noticing them. I find it helpful to understand cultures as well as individuals as being organized around a set of structured principles in the same way. These provide the way that assumptions and values are held. It is within this scaffolding or web that racism shapes itself, so that it is built into the fabric of society in the way that we are not normally cognizant of. The web is something we partake in as individuals, as the culture shapes our ways of understanding the world. It passes, as it were, through us, while also running through the culture. If we see racism existing within organizing principles that run through society and individuals, it is not surprising that we find racism so difficult to eliminate. Getting rid of racism is not just a matter of finding it within us and expunging it. We cannot merely change our mind about it. Larger shifts in cultural consciousness need to occur. We can, though, contribute to bringing to awareness the underlying organizing principles and help reveal them within the culture. I've become mindful of the way in which white people have imposed their own organizing principles globally by racializing the world and by seeing themselves as the superior race. Although racism is largely condemned in contemporary Western society, it continues deeply held within our personal and cultural organizing principles. Our very forgetting about our culpability reveals just how embedded these ideas are and how deeply most of us take for granted what we regard as obvious reality. As a psychotherapist, I've wondered whether what I provide is always appropriate or is just another way of performing whiteness on my black clients. Nevertheless, I find that by staying dialogic and open to communication with them, that my intervention in their lives can be experienced as helpful, particularly when the extended family has broken down or is absent. One asylum seeker client tells me that it makes a difference to him that I am there. He has told me things that he has not been able to talk to others about, and my acceptance of him and desire to understand him mean a lot. Nevertheless, he also says that it would be nice if there were a sympathetic person living in the room next to him, to whom he could open his heart whenever he felt like it. I notice this and wonder if he also needs to be angry with me for not being there for him all of the time. I'm aware of feeling guilty for the small amount of time I'm giving him. Can I take his anger that does not feel safe elsewhere? These experiences have strengthened my belief that dialogic, inquiring, and respectful work can offer something that can run along the web that connects between and across cultures. In any case, complex and interrelationships between different cultural groups make the question of whether our work is suitable for non-Western groups too simplistic to be answered with just yes or no. I've certainly found that it can be. Developing an ability to be in a state of an ongoing inquiry is more important than looking for clear-cut answers. So develop a dialogic and inquiring attitude. Next one. I have found that to keep learning, I need to maintain an inquiring attitude. This idea is current in psychological theorizing. For example, Winnicott's notion of playing within a potential space is similar. This play space is part of what Winnicott calls transitional phenomena, which exists between the internal and external world and allow something new within our sense of self to emerge. As therapists, our exploration of our own responses, or countertransference, if you like that word, also exists within a space of this sort. This notion of a play space allows anything to be held within it, however fanciful or violent or bizarre, as it has not yet entered external reality. It may be important to explore and play with these fantasies with a supervisor. We might find that we are thinking something that is, under normal circumstances, completely unacceptable, like, I want to pin this client up against a wall and shoot him. Not a thought to be conveyed to the client, undigested, but I think most of us would have felt something like this from time to time. We might think, what on earth is all that about? Something is happening that draws me to feel murderous, and in this particular way. Do I feel under threat? Would I enjoy feeling sadistic? Maybe an old experience of mine is being re-stimulated. Maybe I'm picking up a fear or desire of the client's. We might then put it in to one side until something else is said which makes it clearer. My point here is that we do not push away an unacceptable thought, but put it within an orbit of playing so it can be thought about safely and trust that something can be learnt through it. So the next one is, do not dismiss feelings of shame and guilt. Guilt and shame tend to attack our sense of ourselves as good people and can either immobilize us or mean that we defend ourselves against it by denying our guilt. If instead we let it alert us to what is amiss in our relating with those who are not white or Western, then it may be helpful in finding a way to understanding our privilege and gives us some idea of how we make reparation or show us how to behave differently in future. However, we cannot expect to be forgiven or understood by black people. Seeming to say, look how I suffer too, is naive and beside the point. It is likely to alienate black people even further. The natural outcome of real understanding of one's guilt is reparation and restitution. There is often controversy around the idea that colonizers should make reparation and or restitution to those who have been colonized on the grounds that it is all a long time ago and people living today were not responsible. However, white people are still benefiting by the advantages that colonization gave us. The concomitant attitude to black people that are hardwired into us are at quite a fundamental level originate from those times. Our connections with our ancestors are subtle and deeply held. Looked at like this, our guilt appears more evident and reparation and restitution seems more important. Genuine and significant reparation and subsequent restitution could put some of the deep-seated anger and hurt felt by black people to rest. Refusing to do so and only apologize reminds me of a story told at a conference on forgiveness. A man graciously apologized for having taken someone's bicycle. The bicycle owner was pleased to receive the apology, but understandably said, "Thank you, but where is the bike?" Remember that change in the profession comes as part and parcel with changes at individual and societal levels. I haven't said much about organizations, but a chapter is devoted to it in the book, along with chapters on training and supervision. However, it is clear that therapy institutions exist within a wider environment and will affect and be affected by factors beyond their confines. To make a change there needs to be a movement in two directions, from the widest institutions like governments and training institutions who make policies, to individuals and their personal explorations. Both can feed into and support the other to provide a virtuous rather than a vicious cycle. I cannot advocate then that institutions should just come up with better policies or that individuals change their consciousness. Both work together in a synergistic way. Thought is in the culture, and we are affected by it and affect it just as drops of water make a pool, and a pool is full of drops of water. So, in conclusion, I have found ways in which supporting frameworks, such as the White Awareness Model, brings together the personal, interpersonal, group and societal, particularly through understanding the ways that organizing principles run through individuals and groups to provide the way in which thought is structured within, through and around us. This feels to me to be an important shift in perspective that could lead us to less attachment to our own narcissistic desire to have our own point of view win and lead instead to a real acknowledgement of our membership of the human family and the wider world. Thank you.